Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where sales leaders teach you what's working for them and how you can build it yourself.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by our sales coaching and consulting services. Are you looking to create repeatable, scalable, and predictable revenue? We've helped thousands of companies grow their business with tailored expert advice backed by testing to ensure they establish the best practices that'll work for them. Head over to bit.ly/predictable revenue coaching to learn more. We spend a lot of time, especially in kind of the sales advice or sales leadership space, talking about the time to kind of scale up your sales team, get those salespeople in, move away from founder-led sales, when in reality, founder-led sales is a really important phase in the scaling of a company. So we wanted to spend some time to actually dive into that piece of the puzzle today. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks, and today on the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting with an expert about the importance of founder-led sales to scale a startup predictably. He's the founder and CEO at Magical. And prior, he was the founder and CEO of Careerify, a company that built recruiting software that was bootstrapped, had millions in revenue, and sold to LinkedIn in 2015. And post-acquisition, he took leadership PM roles at LinkedIn and Microsoft and was an entrepreneur in residence at Bain Capital Ventures. Harpal Sambi, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Cool. Well, let's dive right into this topic. So talk to me about that first company where, of course, you had great success kind of starting off with that founder-led motion.
Yeah. On a high level, Careerify was a bootstrap company, as you said. It spanned about 6 years. For the first 4 years, we made zero in revenue, zero users. Thankfully, I was with my parents, so I had no mortgage to pay. But I think all in all, we started to kind of like crack the code in the last 18 months, going from zero to over 5 million in ARR. That was repeatable. To your point, at the end, we ended up selling it to LinkedIn. And it was quite a journey, right? Like it was 8 days before going bankruptcy. We felt that moment. We got our first sale that increased our cycle from 1 month to then 3 months to then over a year and then became very profitable. But all in all, it was a ride that we started to learn really quickly what it meant to sell as a founder and trying to bring in our first salespeople and giving them a target of $1 million when we haven't even sold 100,000 was very, very difficult to kind of like fathom. And we start to learn a lot about the intricacies of that entire cycle.
Yeah, I bet. So what do you think about that kind of founder-led selling motion really set you up to predictably scale the company?
Yeah, I think it all in all, founders often have this fallacy, I guess, where they say, okay, I'm going to hire my first salesperson, then my second and third, and sales just ramps up. It's like it's a numerator, right? You take your quota times the number of salespeople, you're going to get that. And often founders that haven't done the allotted of quota for the first salesperson hasn't gone through the repeatable process of all the yeses, all the noes. And as a result, what ends up happening is the founder often gets bogged down once they hire the first salespeople, where the salesperson needs that person, the founder, to close those deals and to go through it. So as a result, there becomes a tension almost where the first salesperson or salespeople and then the founding team, they often have this tension where they're like, the founder's like, well, I hired you to do this job and to take things off of my plate. And the sales team is like, well, hold on. Like I need you to start closing these deals because it's sometimes where we're not at product market fit yet. And we need to sell the vision of the company and what vision, who else better to pitch the vision than the founder, right? So you often have this continuous tension that ends up happening where founders are not setting up their sales team for success.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what do you think that the steps are that the founders should be taking as they're going through this experience themselves, but looking forward to the time where they might be bringing on those next people?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it comes down to kind of like a couple of recipes. Number one is selling the quota that you want your salespeople to sell. That's first and foremost. I think that's a really great proxy for the first salespeople who are looking at a startup for the first time or haven't been in the game or they're setting up something for the first time to understand, well, how am I going to be able to resell repeatably? Second, it's also to kind of like do the ramp ups to say, okay, for the first quarter or two, this person may not be up to speed yet. So when we think about a target, what is realistic? And then three, I think is really around the time and length that it takes. Often a founder will say, okay, it's 6 months to sell and we're going to get down to three. Well, let's show it in a couple of deals, maybe not all the deals, but a few of the deals that we can get a little bit more repeatable in that process itself. I think founders often, like I said, they have that fallacy of just like, we're going to hire these people, they're going to come in, and then your SDRs are having to kind of requalify people because you're not hitting the specific 3 month goal allotment of closing a deal because this might be an enterprise deal or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I think having the right goalposts in mind of what a company is, what an ideal target is, being able to go through the motions and start to create a little bit of a sales playbook is actually really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that one of the pieces kind of within that greater playbook that you emphasize is the softer side, like the more, the soft skills that are associated with that, as opposed to the kind of hard pieces that you put in place. So what do you think the founder can be doing to sort of, I guess, empower that sort of softer side of the process?
Yeah, I'm a big philosophy. I have a big philosophy around creating vulnerability. That is really important. I think vulnerability between a founder and a sales team and the collective group and the clients that you're ultimately trying to pitch and ultimately secure. I remember there's a very distinct story that I had at CareerFi, which was my first customer, which was on the stage of going from 60 days, 30 days, and 8 days of going bankruptcy. I was selling recruiting software, and I called her because she was in HR, and I was like, hey, like, I'm about to like lay off all my employees and go bankrupt. Like, how do I kind of do this? You're in HR. And, normally what she had felt when she would, be approached by prospects and vendors was, hey, I'm trying to give value proposition, sell, sell, sell. And here I'm showing a little bit more of a human side. I'm not even asking her to buy something, even though I pitched her for 2 years prior to that. It was really about like creating a human bond and showing vulnerability of like, hey, I just want to learn and I'm trying to do something different. And what that ended up happening was on the phone call, she was like, hold on, 2 minutes of painful, like awkward silence. She was like, go check your inbox. And sure enough, that was a contract for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, which saved us from that bankruptcy of 8 days to then eventually, you know, getting a couple months of a month of runway and then eventually a couple months of runway. So I think, you know, when you think about vulnerability in the software side, I think the founder and the sales team should have a very transparent conversation where it's like, okay, well, here are the accounts. This is the challenges we're having. How do we unblock this and really get the founder to be kind of like a 10x multiplier and to figure out the repeatability of what she or he are respectively doing when they're coming into a deal to then try to unlock that. And then on the other side, to kind of broach to the prospects for, you know, that you're trying to sell to ultimately be like, hey, this is my first time, you know, trying to build out a sales process and showing that little bit of more vulnerability. The prospects actually, they appreciate it. We're humans, right? We want to have that ability where we're not showing this iron guard across everything. And I think that for us, at least, that provided that aspect of the softer side of the human ability of both internal and external saved a lot. And it was actually one of the biggest factors in growing our company by, you know, 0 to 5 million ARR in like less than 18 months.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because I think a lot of salespeople try to stick to their systems and their processes. And of course, sales leaders try to teach those things so that things are scalable and repeatable and all of that. And often that's where the human element can be lost when you're really trying to stick to a system. But I think generally speaking, founders do have more flexibility to bring their own, you know, authentic character to the sales process because like you said, they're sort of, they're the visionary, they're evangelizing. They don't have to go with a traditional process to kind of get their message across. But it's a lesson there that those little elements of that human and that spark and that, you know, intrigue that the founders can bring to the sales process should be carried forward for the entire life cycle of that company. And that's maybe one of the sort of most important elements that emerged from you doing founder-led selling is like, okay, we've got to hold on to this on the authenticity, this vulnerability and hand that forward to that sales rep.
I would agree, but I would also argue that the founding sales team can also have aspects of this as well, right? Like, I don't think scalability and predictability gets locked into like 25, 50 million in ARR, right? Where you're selling hundreds of thousands of deals. I think you need to have creativity in play where you know what's tried and tested and true, and that becomes a certain percentage, maybe 70, 80%. And you need that flexibility where you say, okay, we're going to take a new territory, or we're going to take a new way of selling potentially on the nodes and just see if they're able to convert. And as a result, you create this, like, you know, that 80-20 rule or whatever the nomenclatures are, where you spend a little bit of time to kind of being creative outside the box, right? Whether it's a different sales technique in terms of a cold email outreach, or conversely, talking to a customer in a different way to kind of like see, like, that you think already from the outset that you're not going to be able to close, right? I think it's really important to have that experimental driven approach that creates authenticity. Because now all of a sudden you're trying to wing it, so to speak, that creates a couple, unlocks hopefully a couple of key insights.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you mentioned obviously the founder, you want to actually sort of go through the motion that you'll expect of a salesperson, figure out what it actually feels like to sell the amount that you expect them to sell before you really can hand that off and it be a realistic sort of expectation. So when do you think is the right moment to start to consider building out that team underneath you as a founder?
Yeah, I do think it's when you start to see more inbound than outbound traditionally. And the proxy that I often look at it is referrals, because founders and the first salesperson or people that come in, they get a certain roster of clients that are just, they're fanatics of the brand, hopefully, right? But you know, you have a higher propensity of referability, and therefore you have a higher NPS by natural, because you're kind of building it before you're having the processes in place. So I often look at that as a key metric, where it's like, okay, like if I have 10 customers, how many are willing to refer me to another customer or more than another customer, and be very intentional about that process. And that is where you start to see, you know, more of the lead gen starting to come in. You know, I would say, like, you know, have your marketing kind of like lockstep, where you have better MQL to SQL conversions. But that being said, you know, I think if you're saying I need to hit, you know, as a maybe a tech company or any company for that matter, I need to go from A to B, whether it's 1 million to 5 million in revenue, just sold the first million. Now you're going to add that first one to two or three salespeople to kind of like help unlock that goal. That's the right time, is when you actually have hit that specific quota. But then you also have started to build a pipeline where people can become successful, because it's really difficult to create pipeline from scratch. So I think that's like a caveat in addition to selling that first, you know, allotment of sales that you need.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that totally makes sense. So what do you think about as far as the actual system, if there's a founder listening right now and they're thinking, okay, I'm starting to approach that, I'm on my way to that number that I could expect a sales rep. What are the actual elements that they should be building out, documenting, systematizing, if anything? I mean, what are some of those?
Yeah, I do think first and foremost, like having a system in place, so like having a little bit of technology can go a long way. I think what practice that I often led to is in my funnel, I wanted to get to a yes or no or a decision point very quickly. So trying to understand that process, because I think the malaise of getting a prospect to say, I'll get back to you, and then you're having this fake pipeline that you're creating. So if there's any process that I do put in place, it's like, how do you get to a decision as soon as possible? And as a founder, you want to codify that as best as possible, even though the target could be different, right? As an example, you can go, you're an SME and you want to go to mid-market, or you want to go into a new vertical. The process of asking the key questions to the yes or no are in my opinion, the most important part, because what you're hiring for is time of people to kind of go out there and build pipeline and talk to prospects to then get that. And if you don't have a system in place to get to the yes or no, then I think you have like that issue. You know, territory planning, you don't need that, right? Or, you know, trying to figure out which types of, like, you know, codifying, like what industries do you need to go to. Again, I think the world's your oyster ultimately when you're starting to hire your first to 10 people. It's really about the process. And then with the no's, it's really about the extraction of like what went wrong, how to kind of like think about that. And that's where the playbook kind of comes in, where I've seen some people just don't go back to their rejections, and a month or 3 months later when things are cool and they've already selected their vendor, to just like reach out to them and say, you know, things went wrong in my opinion, but totally respect your opinion on, and I hope you're having great success. But I just want to know from a key learning perspective. And I'm surprised at how many people actually took that call, right? Without any incentivization. And that really creates the ability to boomerang. So eventually if they are not having a good issue, they remember that you're seeking for recommendation and advice, which is great. But more importantly, you're now starting to understand in the outside of the heat of the moment, what things we can correct and now have to highlight to now that the salespeople that you're hiring can avoid those landmines or make sure that they have proactive material around. So I think those are like the two key areas of the process is codifying to the yes or no. And for the no's, post out of the battle, just really trying to understand that so you can start to build some of the playbook of the objections before the head of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe even get a bit of a sort of finer honed sense of who your ideal customer is when you're seeing, okay, we really went for this part of the market. Turns out they don't really see the value in what we're bringing to them. Or maybe there's just some big player who's just, you know, already cannibalized like 3/4 of that market. And so it's better to carve it out somewhere else. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, a little bit of a pivot here, because you are also a kind of an expert in the world of LinkedIn and LinkedIn prospecting. So I wanted to pick your brain about that as well while we have you here. So let's talk a little bit about that and what you're seeing working these days on LinkedIn.
Yeah. It was funny because when we sold our company to LinkedIn, I went into LinkedIn Talent Solutions, which is the recruiting aspect of it. But that's a very, the sister organization is LinkedIn Sales Solution. And sales and recruiters, in my opinion, have the same kind of prerogative. They're just selling different, they're one selling a set of services and a product, the other one selling a dream, right? Of a really great job. So like, I think ideally they have a lot of traits, even though their KPIs can be a little bit different.
Sure.
One thing that we found, before I get into a serious process aspect of what tangibly we can do, but Free Puppies was actually the number one converted open to reply rate at one point in 2018 when I was still there, that had an absurd amount of like just having the subject line of Free Puppies. I had amazing open rates, amazing click-through rates, and the best reply rate on aggregate from those people that actually just submit it. On average, LinkedIn obviously has a lot of privacy in mind, which then allows or doesn't allow the salesperson to ultimately find the right person, because you know part of the whole process of SDRing, or maybe you're a hunter, you're trying to find the right person, and LinkedIn search sometimes obfuscates a certain user based on their privacies. So the best way of actually finding that CEO or finding that end up that the decision maker is just going on Google and just typing in title, company, and then letting Google to go around the obfuscation versus like the head of sales that you're trying to sell towards says to LinkedIn, I don't want to be really searched as often, because you often sometimes say like CEO of X company and you're like, where is the CEO profile, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of like a really quick way, because time is money at the end of the day for we as salespeople. Mm-hmm. The search bar is very contextual in terms of what you're searching for. I think more proactive salespeople know the whole world of Boolean searching. But if you don't know about the term of Boolean search, I think if you start to know the and or parameters and the facets, you don't have to buy some of the premium products by just using the basic search. And then as a result, you're less than 100 profiles that you can search. Because LinkedIn, I think after 100 or 10 pages, they tell you that, hey, you need to get upgraded. You can get around some of those things by just like tweaking kind of your searches if you want to kind of go down that path and just making your life easier. And then also like tens of thousands of our users on Magical today, which were a productivity tool, anyone that has like hi XXX, I see you're at YYY company, Magical can help with that by just like, you know, templating that and making your life a lot more easier. So those are three, I think, right off the bat, outside of free puppies, which often gets the biggest bang for your buck in terms of reply rates and open rates.
That's interesting. And what about kind of the flip side? What are some of the things, I mean, I'm sure you see people doing things all the time that you think are like, oh, that's not the way to do it. What are some of those mistakes people are making with LinkedIn?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think first and foremost, it's trying to rely on in-mails as its own way. I think it's, you know, if someone has done a lot of A/B tests, they can see, at least for myself, at least, emails probably still, like SMS is probably the biggest one. But sometimes in wherever world you are, that may or may not fly that well. If you can't do SMS, go email. If you can't go email or Discord or Slack channels, et cetera, then in-mail can go really well, and then tweets and et cetera. But I often find that sales reps sometimes look to get a higher premium SKU, but then they're not tapping into kind of the world of like, how do I get this person's email to then ultimately shoot them that respective message versus notifying and noticing that, you know, sometimes this end person that we're trying to send this message to may not be checking LinkedIn, which is the biggest challenge for them. Mm-hmm. All right. And often the emails are associated to the personal versus professional or to a secondary email. So it's just deliverability is probably like the number one biggest thing that people fail to realize, that you kind of have to have an all-encompassing way to sell to Sarah Hicks, and probably best not to go to Sarah Hicks LinkedIn, because she may or may not see it as often as possible. And therefore you're only reducing your ability to sell. I think that's like number one. Number two is also how many people like change your profiles on a continuous basis. I think, you know, if you're selling to specific verticals, so let's say salespeople, recruiters, forward tech companies, like startups, you're going to have a more up-to-date profile. But if you're starting to go into like healthcare or to pharma or to like manufacturing, those profiles are not being as updated as possible because those people are not as frequent users on LinkedIn. So you kind of have to play the game of like, okay, is my persona on LinkedIn a lot? And therefore, do I trust that their profile is up to date as much as possible versus like I'm trying to sell to engineers and engineers are not on LinkedIn. They're probably more on GitHub. So you probably have to kind of like then twist, like, rethink your framing of like what is the most up-to-date information, which unfortunately kind of has ripple effects because like a lot of ingestion systems like Zoom Info or other systems use LinkedIn to ultimately get the most relevant data. But it, you know, we all see bounce rates. We all see people are saying like, I'm no longer at that company. And you're like, okay, there goes that. But like, I think just having a forward-looking way of like, is my contact there? That works well. And the other one that I forgot to mention is that works really well is groups. That's a very under-leveraged, it used to be a very leveraged asset, I would say, in the 2015, 2016. It's gone to a little bit of the back burner, so to speak. But if you find niche groups that are active, those are a big boon in order to get like the right persona. And those are often under-leveraged as well.
Cool. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for walking us through that. And of course, for walking us through the whole importance of founder-led sales as this step that's in the greater kind of scaling journey of companies. If people want to learn more from you, if they want to learn more about Magical, where can they do that?
Yeah, great. On a high level, LinkedIn, Twitter, I'm there. If you start typing in Harpal, I'm usually like the only profile that kind of comes up or one of the few. Harpal Sambi is the one. And so that's on H Sambi for LinkedIn and for Twitter. For Magical, they just have to go to getmagical.com and they can take a look. And we do have wait lists, but feel free to just drop predictable revenue and happy to send everyone to the top of the line there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again for joining us. It was a pleasure having you.
Likewise. Thank you, Sarah.
And thank you to all of you for joining us for another episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. Please, if you haven't already, hit that subscribe button on YouTube so that you can be notified each week when we have great guests like Harpal Sambi joining us and walking us through all the latest tips and tricks for sales, marketing, and everything in between. Thanks again. We'll catch you next time.